Today on Maine Calling, Ebola, then and now. Ebola is once again in the news with outbreaks in Congo and Uganda. And again, the U.S. government policy in response to Ebola is drawing criticism. 7 U.S. aid workers are currently isolated at a controversial quarantine facility in Kenya. 12 years ago, Maine became a flashpoint in the response to the Ebola epidemic after a rescue flight refueled in Bangor and a public health nurse returned home. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we talk with Casey Hickox, that public health nurse at the center of the storm in 2014, and Patty White, the Maine public journalist who covered the story. We'll also meet an author whose new book is about the daring rescue of Ebola patients during that outbreak, and an Ebola expert based here in Maine. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Support for Maine Calling comes from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine. Now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Ebola is once again in the news, as an outbreak in Central Africa has claimed an estimated 1,500 lives. In 2014, an Ebola outbreak in West Africa became one of the largest and deadliest epidemics in history, and Maine came under the spotlight after a rescue plane landed at the Bangor International Airport, and then again when a public health nurse from Maine returned home after treating patients in Africa. Joining me today to talk about what happened in 2014 and its relevance to what's happening now, Kevin Hazard, who is the author of the book, No One's Coming, The Rogue Heroes Our Government Turns to When There's Nowhere Else to Turn. Casey Hickox is an infection prevention nurse. She is the nurse who helped people with Ebola in Sierra Leone and then later defied quarantine orders in Maine. Also with me, my colleague Patty White. She's a reporter and host for Maine Public. She covered that Ebola news in 2014. Join the conversation. What do you remember about the Ebola-related events of 2014? Are you concerned about Ebola spreading to the U.S.? Are you watching the news today? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call. 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you all for joining us. And Casey, I will start with you. Take us back to 2014. Why were you in Sierra Leone? What were you doing there?
Thanks, Jennifer. My name's Casey, and I have worked with Doctors Without Borders. Some of you may know the organization as Médecins Sans Frontières, or MSF, and I have worked for them on and off for many years in Africa, Asia, and even in one of their headquarters in Amsterdam in the Netherlands. And so in 2014, I was between assignments. I wasn't working full-time with Doctors Without Borders, but as you know, the Ebola outbreak was so large, traveling to 3 different countries in West Africa, and they sent an email out saying, we need people, we need doctors, we need nurses, we need water and sanitation experts, logisticians, all the people that are required for this type of response. And I was sitting around a campfire on a canoe trip, and my friends said, well, you should definitely go, how many people have sort of the skills and the ability to help support this outbreak response. And so I went. I went as a nurse, and I was the medical team lead for a 32-bed Ebola treatment unit in Sierra Leone.
And it was, tell us what it was like to be there. I can't even imagine the scene. Can you describe it?
Yeah, Ebola is such a terrible disease. Similar things are happening in the DRC today, but basically, either hospital wards or tents are set up to isolate and treat people. And one of the reasons that's part of the foundation of the response is because if people stay in their homes or in a normal hospital ward, then transmission will happen and more people will get Ebola. So the more we can identify people who have Ebola and isolate them in a treatment unit and give them the best care that we possibly can, the better. The circumstances are very challenging. I'm sure you all remember or have seen recently pictures of the full PPE that we have to wear when we're taking care of Ebola patients. Once they get very weak, oftentimes patients can't even stand up. They can hardly sit up in their bed on their own. They can start having severe diarrhea and vomiting and just that extreme weakness. And so taking care of them is very challenging on top of doing that in full personal protective equipment. And as you know, the mortality rate of Ebola, you know, can kind of approach 50% in this current outbreak in DRC. It's at about 44% case fatality rate as far as the numbers we know. So that's also just incredibly disheartening. You know, imagine being at your family reunion and 50% of those people at your family reunion who you love not making it at the end of the week.
And Casey, were you afraid when you were over there that you would contract it? And or did you have complete confidence in the PPE?
I think everyone has a healthy amount of fear who responds to an Ebola outbreak. But at the same time, Doctors Without Borders has been responding to Ebola outbreaks now for over 50 years. And before the outbreak in 2014, there had never been an international staff who had contracted Ebola. The reason I say international staff is because it's kind of challenging to separate whether people living in the community were exposed in an Ebola treatment unit versus exposed in the community. But so, you know, the picture of all of that PPE, you know, the yellow Tyvek suit and the white thick apron and, you know, long gloves that go kind of up to the elbows eye protection, you know, all of that works very well. And the doffing procedures work very well. And we do know how to take care of Ebola patients and keep health workers safe when we invest in all the resources, the structures and the PPE necessary.
All right. Well, I'm going to return to you, Casey, and ask you what happened when you returned to Maine in just a minute. But I'm going to turn to Kevin because Casey mentioned that for many, many years, not a single international medical personnel was infected until this 2014 epidemic, Kevin. And this is part of what you write about in your book, that there was a doctor, an American doctor, who was very sick, and there was a very unconventional rescue effort to try to get him out and to treatment that could save his life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he wasn't, you know, Kent Brantley was not a physician with MSF. He was with Samaritan's Purse, an American organization. But, you know, they were doing the same work at the time that this was happening. Samaritan's Purse and MSF were the entirety of the international response. And, you know, they were at best a finger in the dam. Samaritan's Purse is a much smaller organization, and they were trying to hold down Liberia. The capital city alone has 1 million people, and they had about 12 volunteers. So, you know, here Casey at the end there said, you know, we believe in the processes, we believe in our, you know, our knowledge and our equipment when all the resources have been properly placed. The resources weren't properly placed, and they knew that when they arrived in Liberia, they weren't arriving for an Ebola outbreak. You know, Kent Brantley is a family doctor. That's what he was planning to do. So they stepped up to do something that they weren't prepared to do. And nobody helped them in terms of equipment or, you know, any kind of assistance with personnel. So they were all by themselves. Kent Brantley, he has some idea of maybe how he got sick, but he's really not certain. But nonetheless, he contracted Ebola. And very shortly after, another volunteer contracted Ebola. So this was around the same time that Dr. Umar Khan had died. And there was a large international concern that you have three countries that are on the brink of collapse because the countries have been overrun by this Ebola outbreak. And the medical resources, the local medical resources, weren't enough to hold up. So the question is, how do we get international help to come in if that international help keeps dying? Dr. Umar Khan, Sierra Leonean, but he was the face of the effort. And so his death was really a blow to the international medical community. And now, on the heels of that, two more people get sick. So this effort is spun up to get them home to try to give them treatment because at that time in Liberia, what they were seeing at their hospital, those mortality rates were 70%, they were 80%. They were getting incredibly high. So there was real concern about whether or not Kent Brantley could live or Nancy Reipold, the volunteer, could live. But when they tried to bring them home, what they found was no country would allow them to land. And in fact, no country would allow a rescue plane through their airspace. When you think about that for a moment, they weren't even allowed to fly over another country because, of course, there's always the contingent that, a plane might have to land, and what are you going to do? Your plane makes an emergency landing, and a hatch pops open, and then suddenly all these zombies come rolling out. I mean, that's what people were envisioning. And so everybody said no. So the U.S. State Department, which did not get involved but was willing to sort of facilitate this effort, said, who can do something really dangerous and really weird, and who can do it really fast and really effectively? Because what they were proposing was to bring these two Americans home to the US, a country that obviously did not have an Ebola outbreak. And the going wisdom was, do not bring, the guy at the State Department, he used the phrase, you don't bring zombies to a place without the zombie apocalypse. And so, that's what they were up against, was a lot of people saying, we don't have Ebola here. Good God, don't bring Ebola.
So how
And the
was
State
it,
Department,
Kevin? I'm going to make you fast forward a little bit because, a whole bunch of your book, it's really interesting, exciting, is about this unusual airline or air service that brings these people who these patients over to the U.S. But this is where Maine becomes part of the story. How is it that they land in Bangor, Maine, and what was the reaction?
Well, the company, Phoenix Air, had been doing a lot of these transports for a very long time now, all sorts of dangerous materials. And because of the geography of the US coastline, anything coming from Africa, sort of like just Maine was the perfect location for it. And then you add on to that, that Bangor has this huge airfield. The airport there has this very long runway, and it was designed, for these sorts of the shuttle could land there. And the guy who was running the customs, the port for U.S. Customs, named John Nadeau, who's a Maine resident. He used to say to his neighbors, if you guys had any idea what was flying over your heads, you would not be able to sleep at night. And so a lot of strange things were coming into Bangor because of its location, because of this runway that it had. And so the original plan was, hey, we're going to bring this thing into Maine. We've got this containment system, this really crazy piece of technology. We're going to bring in a Gulfstream G3 jet, and it's going to land. We're going to transfer pilots. Patient will stay put, and then we'll go. And Nadeau sat down and he talked with the people at Phoenix. He listened to their plan. He evaluated the safety of himself, his crew, everybody at the airport, essentially the city of Bangor slash state of Maine. And he said, this sounds great to me. Let's go ahead and do it. And as soon as he said yes, as happened, Maine was not alone. As happened in Atlanta, basically the world around him turned, lit on fire. The local government was not happy. People running the airport were not happy. He was getting angry phone calls from congressmen and from senators. People were really upset that this was going to happen. And they all turned to him and said, why on earth are you allowing this to happen? Why are you putting us all at risk? And his argument all along was, you've got people dying, and we have an opportunity to be part of the rescue. So what are you going to do? Are you just going to let that plane fly around until it runs out of fuel and crash? Or are we going to do the right thing? And are we going to step up? And are we going to save Americans? That logic didn't win him any friends, but he stuck to it. And we often, the word bureaucrat is sort of tossed around as this ugly word. But what a bureaucrat really is someone who has dedicated themselves to becoming an expert in one little tiny field that, it's something that, government takes over where business won't, things that won't make money. And, so a bureaucrat is an expert in a field that's not going to make the rest of us or himself or anyone else a lot of money, but it's going to protect people, it's going to serve people. And, that's, John Doe is the perfect example of that. He's a person who stood up for what he thought was right, what he felt we could do, what we needed to do. And, he said, "Look, I understand the concerns here, but I work for the federal government, not for the state of Maine or the city of Bangor, and I say yes."
Well, that sets the stage for you to come home, Stacy. This is already, Casey, this has already happened in Maine, that this incident has happened with the plane, and it's been big news. And then you come home to Fort Kent from Sierra Leone. You don't fly in a rescue plane because you don't have Ebola. You're just on your way home. You landed in New Jersey, right? On a regular commercial plane, right?
Correct, yes.
And then what happened?
So, just also for a little context, other than what was going on in Maine, I landed, I believe it was the very day after Craig Spencer, a physician from the US who had worked with Doctors Without Borders, he is a friend of mine, was diagnosed in New York City. So at that point, several governors of several states decided that they would implement quarantine, initially kind of voluntary quarantine, but also quarantine orders when needed. So when I arrived, I had traveled through Brussels to do a debriefing with Doctors Without Borders, and the sort of welcome into the Brussels office was very different than when I landed in New Jersey, but I, of course, told the immigration officer, at the airport that I had been to West Africa treating Ebola patients, and he stepped away and went and got the people that work for the U.S. Quarantine Authority who took me, to this area of the airport and started asking me questions about my exposure risks. To which I sort of explained to them that I had been treating Ebola patients, but with no breaches in PPE or high-risk exposure events. So, I was taken to a tent in New Jersey and held from Friday to Monday, and finally was released after my lawyers got involved. And I'm not sure how long I would have stayed in that tent had I not had really excellent civil rights lawyers. But then I was driven to Maine in an unmarked SUV with three emergency medical technicians.
Who were not? How were those emergency medical technicians dressed, Casey? Were they afraid of you?
They were not. They were in normal clothes. I asked them that question when I got in to the SUV. Actually, Governor Christie wanted to transport me in an ambulance, and myself and my lawyers refused that, partially because of the optics. It would have made it look like I was sick, and I was not sick in any way. But I asked them if they were afraid, and they said, "No, we understand Ebola and how it's transmitted, and that if you're not symptomatic, there's no way that you could give us Ebola, even if you do have it incubating in your blood and develop symptoms in a couple of days." So they were given the choice to wear personal protective equipment, and they chose not to do so.
Well, we're going to continue the story after the break, and we're going to bring Patty White into the conversation as well. But we do need to take a quick break. We're talking about Ebola then and now. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are talking about Ebola, not only the recent outbreak, but also the 2014 outbreak that led to Maine being in the national news. My guest, Casey Hickox, who's an infection prevention nurse and found herself in the uncomfortable spot of being in the national news. Also, Kevin Hazard, a journalist whose recent book is called No One's Coming, and Patty White, Maine Public News reporter. Share your comments and questions. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or call 1-800-399-3566. Casey, we're going to pick up the story. You got home to Fort Kent, Maine, and you were told to stay inside. Did you?
That is true. I was told to stay inside. I think a lot of people in general don't understand what quarantine laws look like. They look different in every state. The state of Maine happens to have a law where you have to go to a judge, to a court, to get a court issued order. But public health and whoever else is making quarantine decisions can just ask you to voluntarily stay at home. And because I knew that I was asymptomatic and therefore there was no way I could transmit Ebola, and understanding the ethics of quarantine, which include that you really should use the least restrictive means necessary to protect the public health. I was talking to my attorneys, and basically that is how the bike ride came about. I don't know how many of you saw pictures of that bike ride, but I basically had to leave my house so that public health would go to a judge and get a court order to quarantine me so that I could have due process and argue my case as to why quarantine was not necessary.
All right. Well, this is where Patty White, you come in. You've been a healthcare reporter for a long time. I'm guessing this is unlike any story you've ever covered.
Totally. It was a really fascinating story to cover just because it was this mystery that was unfolding every single day. I mean, we knew that Casey, main news outlets picked up on the story when Casey was in New Jersey because we knew that her ultimate destination was Maine. And then when she was released, we knew she was coming here. We weren't exactly sure where she was going to head, you know, maybe Fort Kent, but who knows if she was going to change her plans. And then once she was here, it's, you know, we know she's doesn't agree with the quarantine. She's probably going to break it. How is she going to do it? How's the state going to respond? It was just every day there were all these questions, and it was a really fascinating story.
So you got in a car and drove to Fort Kent.
That's right. So when Casey was released from New Jersey, like I said, you know, it was unclear exactly where she might head to in Maine. So we sort of took a gamble and thought, okay, let's just get someone up there. And when I first got there, there were just a couple other news outlets, local news outlets that were there. And then within about a day or a day and a half, I think it became clear that Casey wasn't Fort Kent. And there was this dramatic change. You know, we had been stationed on this quiet residential street where Casey's partner lived, where she was, where we thought she was staying. And then the next day, after it was known that Casey was indeed in Fort Kent, I remember turning onto that street and there was just this sea of cars lining the side of the road. It was news outlets from across the country who came because, again, it was a big story. I mean, Ebola was very much on people's minds. I remember doing local stories about how the state was preparing if Ebola came to Maine. A lot of states were, this was a question people had. So that's why there was just so much attention on this story.
Well, and for the record, Casey, you never got Ebola, right?
That is correct.
Oh my goodness. Go ahead.
Oh, I used to sign some of my emails, the nurse that never had Ebola, because everyone called me the Ebola nurse, but really, it wasn't quite true.
So you go out on this bike ride. I just have to ask you about it. You know that you're doing something to trigger a legal process. You know that there are probably cameras and reporters outside. Were you ready for how many cameras and journalists were outside? What was your experience?
I could see all of the news vans outside of the window of the house. In fact, at one point, we put up cardboard kind of along the windows so that, you know, there wouldn't be a crack and people wouldn't be looking through the windows of the house in the evenings. You know, I was surprised that there was that much media attention around this. And I, to be honest, I didn't want to go outside and talk to the media. I didn't want, any of this to happen. But I kept thinking, well, if no one fights for our due process rights, then, two things will happen. It could hurt individuals, not only regarding this response, but, maybe someone who is part of other infectious disease contact investigations in the future. But also, I was really worried about it hampering the response in West Africa. And I have the same concern today about some of the decisions that especially the US administration has made. But so, yeah, I didn't want to go outside and go for a bike ride, but I knew I had to. I knew I had to get to a court so that I could argue why quarantine doesn't make sense in the case of Ebola.
And in case people don't remember, you did win in court.
That is correct. Judge Leverdier basically requested 24 hours so he could review the law and review the evidence that my lawyers and I submitted, as well as the state of Maine submitted. And 24 hours later, we were on a call. It was around noon, actually. I wasn't on the call, but my lawyers called me and said, "You're free." The judge has ruled in your favor and said that the state of Maine did not meet their burden of proof that letting you go outside of your house would put people in danger.
Patty, what was the reaction to that judgment?
The state, Paula Page was the governor at the time, and I mean, he said he would abide by, the law and what the court decided, but he definitely said he was not happy about the decision. I mean, he even said he didn't trust Casey. So it just kind of was an example, when she, as I said before, before Casey came to Maine, Ebola was on people's minds because there was just concern that the outbreak would spread to the US. And states were saying, okay, and including Maine, okay, we've got this protocol in place, we're going to follow US CDC guidelines. But then when it's clear that someone who's been in a region where there has been Ebola is coming to Maine, then the state changes its tune and institutes a protocol that goes above and beyond US CDC guidelines, which is what led to this kind of showdown, challenging where Casey wanted to challenge that. So I think just interesting to see how the state, on the one hand, before Casey came, said, okay, we've got this under control, we know what we're going to do. And then they changed their tune. And then, that prompted a response from the medical community, which over the course of the week, when the story was unfolding, it was medical organizations, it was former public health officials who came out in support of Casey and said, they really encouraged the LePage administration to make decisions based on evidence, not based on fear. They said that what it was doing was really kind of stoking fear.
And Kevin, this is a big part of what you write about, right? Because there was a huge backlash in Atlanta as well when a doctor was admitted to a hospital there. This whole idea of what we know and what is evidence-based versus panic and public fear.
Yeah, I mean, people, when it comes to diseases, I think rightfully people don't fully understand. Anytime that there's a, when cholera was first a big thing, the flu pandemic in the beginning of the century, and then, again, obviously with Ebola, when there's a lack of knowledge, that confusion and that lack of knowledge turns to fear, the fear turns to anger. Atlanta, the hospital that treated those patients had bomb threats. There were protesters ringing the building when the ambulance went through the city. The FBI followed them because they were afraid that someone might hijack the ambulance and try to weaponize Kent Brantley's body. There was that much fear and that much anger. A lot of people were saying, don't do this. If you do, the doctors are going to be washing their hands at this hospital and this Ebola blood's going to run into the drains and then rats are going to get Ebola and they're going to come bursting from the sewers and you're going to have this crazy Ebola outbreak. And what happened was two patients arrived at a hospital that was fully prepared. Those patients were well treated in an ICU environment, and they were released a couple of weeks later, Ebola free, and walked out into the world and have since retaken their place in the global public health community. If you look at the opposite of that, a man hops a plane in Africa unaware that he's sick. He lands in Dallas. He gets transported because he's symptomatic. By the time he lands, he gets transported to a hospital that is not prepared. And two healthcare workers get sick and almost die. There's a big difference there. And I think there's a huge lesson that we can learn, listening to Patty, listening to Casey. All you hear is this idea of, this fear and overreaction and not listening to the science. Here's a perfect example of one hospital understood the science and everybody followed it and everyone lived and no one got sick. And another hospital that was not ready for it. And, healthcare workers get sick. I mean, the evidence and the steps, the progression of how this can go, versus how it should go, it's pretty clear. And you can watch it, and we're watching it happen again. Just because this current outbreak is there does not mean that it won't come here. In 2014, a man stepped off a plane in Lagos, which is the most populous city in Africa, symptomatic for Ebola. And again, a man stepped off a plane in Dallas, symptomatic for Ebola. So what is in one spot will inevitably make its way to another, and we all need to be prepared for that.
Okay, and just to be clear, Casey, you mentioned this before that if you do not have symptoms, you cannot spread the disease. But if you do have symptoms, how is it spread? What needs to happen?
Yeah, as time progresses, then the levels of virus basically in your blood and body increase over time. And so, again, by that day three, four, five, when you start having vomiting and diarrhea, that's when the level of the virus is high enough that you can transmit it through blood or bodily fluids. So, yeah, vomit, feces, can transmit Ebola at that point.
You mentioned something earlier, Casey. You said the ethics of quarantine. And I want you to explain that more quickly because a lot of people listening might think to themselves, why not exercise an abundance of caution? Why not just stay in your house for a couple weeks? Explain what you mean by the ethics of quarantine.
Yeah, well, there's really a framework in public health for when to use quarantine and how to use quarantine. And that framework includes a fairness principle. So if you are going to quarantine for a disease or a situation, it should be applied across the board. There shouldn't be certain people that it gets applied to and other people that it doesn't. And it's also about the measures that you can take to protect the public. So, again, with Ebola, if you can monitor for symptoms, then the risk of one person who's incubating Ebola virus within their body transmitting to someone else is very low, unlike the common flu, right, where you're infectious 24 hours before you start developing symptoms. And the least restrictive means necessary. And really, I think that is the key issue with Ebola. Again, we know that we can monitor people. They can monitor themselves. We can have check-ins with public health once a day. And that is plenty. That's exactly what Craig Spencer did in New York City. As soon as he developed symptoms, he stayed in his room, he contacted public health, and he got to the right place where he could get care. And he didn't transmit Ebola. And the gentleman in Dallas, Thomas Eric Duncan, he was at home for multiple days with several family members living in an apartment, and neither of those family members contracted Ebola from him. So, the evidence is very clear that Ebola isn't like measles. It's not like influenza. And so we really have to take public health measures according to how a disease is transmitted.
And you talk about fairness, Casey. I know that you've thought about the analogies here and how, for example, the cruise ship passengers who had hantavirus are being treated differently than the children in another state who have measles, which is more is easier to catch.
Yeah, exactly. The Even within the cruise ship passengers, right? We know that there were a group of passengers that got off the ship before it was kind of quarantined, before the hantavirus outbreak had been identified. But those people were also exposed to patient zero, which we kind of know more about the epidemiology at this point. So we have half the people quarantined in a unit in Nebraska, and half the people allowed to be monitored at home, not even necessarily quarantined. And I think that's a really great example of sort of red flags showing us that something is not right in the way that we're implementing public health measures. And for me, it always triggers that alarm bell that politics are getting involved in public health decisions.
Well, we need to take another break. What are your questions about Ebola? 1-800-399-3566, our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today we're talking about Ebola, not only the recent outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Uganda, but looking back at the 2014 outbreak that led to Maine being in the national news. My guest today, Casey Hickox, who is an infection prevention nurse and was the nurse who did not get Ebola in 2014. Kevin Hazard, a journalist, TV writer, and author. His recent book is No One's Coming. And Patty White, Maine Public News reporter. Share your comments and questions. You can send a brief email if you hurry to talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or call 1-800-399-3566. Okay, now for the tricky question, Patty. Have we learned any lessons?
I wish I could say that we have it. It doesn't really feel that way. I'm sad to say that. I mean, you think about what Casey just talked about with the hantavirus example, the response to that. And a year ago, I did a story about local doctors here in Maine who are just increasingly confronting misinformation in the exam room, family medicine physicians, pediatricians, emergency room doctors. So I think this kind of skepticism and fear of science and evidence is alive and well, unfortunately. I mean, the US Surgeon General in 2021 issued an advisory saying that misinformation was a huge threat to public health. So it's still very much a problem. And it's discouraging to, maybe talk about it that way. I do find hope in that there are still people who follow science and evidence who stand up for that. So, it's important to know that there are people who still stand up for for science.
On the line with us now is John Keenly, who's the CEO of Partners for World Health, which is based here in Maine and conducts aid missions all over the world. John, I know that you came to this job with years of experience working on public health issues in Africa. Tell us about your experience with Ebola.
Yeah, thank you, Jennifer. So I joined Partners for World Health in September of last year after a 15-year career with USAID, serving exclusively in Africa, first South Africa, then Zambia and Kenya. And I was in South Africa when I remember the 2014 Ebola outbreak, and I was following that story with Casey very, very closely. So it's wonderful to be able to hear this side of the story. Most recently, with USAID, I was in Kenya, where we were supporting both the Kenyan government and the Ugandan government with the outbreak there that happened more recently. But with Partners for World Health, what we have been focusing on is collecting surplus medical supplies and equipment from hospitals across New England, Massachusetts, Maine, and sending shipments to places like Bunia, which is the capital of Ituri Province in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and equipping them with PPE, and working closely with the Red Cross on the ground there, to make sure that healthcare workers that are on the front lines of this current response have everything that they need.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, John, and thank you for the good work you do. John Keenly, CEO of Partners for World Health. We'll go to Jamie, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Jamie. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Just a question about the transmission. So when they say bodily fluids, so is coughing part of, because if you cough, you have, you know, you're obviously putting some type of aerosol out, you know, that's maybe the wrong word. I'm not a technical person, but is that considered, you know, bodily fluids in a sense? If somebody is symptomatic, they cough, maybe this is with any disease, you know, when they cough, is that considered bodily fluid that it's your, I guess,
yeah,
it's your mucus,
it's a
right?
good question, yeah. Jamie. Casey, what would you say about spreading Ebola? Is it possible that someone could cough on someone else and they breathe in the droplets and contract it?
Yeah, it absolutely is. It's probably not the most common route of transmission for Ebola. As I mentioned, once you progress in the disease, it's that, you know, profuse vomiting and diarrhea where most of the virus will live. But sure, if someone was symptomatic and had Ebola, the virus definitely could be transmitted through respiratory secretions and a cough.
There you go, Jamie. Thank you for your call. We have an email here from Maggie. I believe the controversy around Hickox being in Maine and leaving quarantine aided Paul LePage in winning re-election. It was my first thought when I heard of the news of the current Ebola outbreak in Congo. Patty, it was a political football, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, I guess I feel like I'd have to ask our political reporters for their take on that. I don't know for sure. But I mean, people had really strong feelings. Yeah. And I guess, as we said before, I think fear is pretty powerful. And we also talked before about the least restrictive quarantine measures. And I think the LePage administration was saying, oh, we would just, out of an abundance of caution, this is why we were doing this. So it sounds like, okay, we're asking for something really reasonable, but it was outside or it went beyond US CDC guidelines.
Well, speaking of politics, go ahead, Casey.
Well, one of the things that I said back then and still stand by is that, to me, as a public health expert and someone who really knows well how Ebola is transmitted and what's needed to, to contain it, it was all an abundance of politics, not an abundance of caution.
Well, Casey, let's talk about today, because, again, Ebola is in the news, and again, it's political. The United States has built a quarantine center, an isolation center. There are people there in Kenya, not here in the U.S., in Kenya. You have strong feelings about this, don't you?
I do. Some other things that our current administration, that Trump and others in his cabinet have done is implemented a do not board list. So Americans who have been in DRC are not allowed on a commercial plane flying back to the U.S. Of course, there's this facility in Kenya. And, all of these things are concerning because, again, if I have worked in the DRC and I have no symptoms and don't have a high risk exposure to Ebola, then we've already built a whole system to support monitoring aid workers who are returning from an Ebola outbreak. That system works. We learned a lot of lessons in 2014. And so allowing people to come back to America, making sure that we're supporting our citizens as well as supporting the outbreak response is really the best thing that we can do to keep Americans safe.
Kevin, what about you? When you look at the news about not only what's happening right now in Africa, but how the United States is responding, what are your thoughts, having spent a lot of time researching what happened in 2014?
The doctors who were involved then that I've spoken to now all mourn the fact that all of this acquired knowledge was allowed to slip away, and we find ourselves right back where we were, which I'm sure is probably a situation Casey finds herself in every day. It is the fact that we're stashing Americans in Kenya is a bit shameful. You know, in the wake of 2014, what we realized was we didn't have enough infectious disease beds, and a great effort was put to increase those. So it wasn't just Emory in Atlanta, and it wasn't just Lincoln, Nebraska. It was spread around the country. Great effort was also put into by political entities and government and private business into creating a safe way to transport larger numbers of people by air in a biocontainment unit. We have all those abilities now, and they are just sitting collecting dust, sort of awaiting the okay to say, okay, you know, go ahead and do these things that we already know we can do, that you know, things that we created over a decade ago. That we're not doing it, that we've shoved all
and
that
we
aside.
Spent a lot of money on them, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
We're going to go to Ethan calling from Saco. Hi, Ethan. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I find it, shocking or confusing that you earlier said that it's lawful to not lock down people, yet during COVID, and right at this time, Fauci is being grilled in Congress. So I find it weird, at the least, that, you know, you guys are advocating it's not lawful to lock down, yet we went through 2 years, and I have court cases that I fought myself with my own money in the Libertarian Party against the unconstitutionality of it.
Yeah, Ethan, we're tight on time, so I'm going to turn this back to Casey. I think probably a lot of people see an irony in that you fought quarantine, but yet a few years later, we were all being asked to quarantine or ordered to quarantine.
Exactly. And I think that could be an entire show to talk about COVID quarantine and the COVID response in general. But, you know, COVID is very easily transmitted through the air, even when people are mildly symptomatic. And so, again, from an infectious disease perspective, I think these are just the things that we have to take into account. That is not the case in Ebola. So monitoring and not quarantining is the right decision. But for measles and COVID and, you know, sometimes tuberculosis, we have to take a different strategy depending on the disease.
Ethan, thanks for your call. We'll go up to Fort Kent and Arthur. Hi, Arthur. Go ahead.
Hello. When I heard Casey's name mentioned, it was like, I know who that is, being from Fort Kent. I just drove by the Violet Settlement Road where the infamous bike ride took place. It was quite the national media sensation around here. We're known for the Ploy Festival and the dog sled races. So this was quite something.
I can imagine. Arthur, thanks so much for calling. Casey, we just have about a minute and a half left. What are you doing now? You're working with Ebola response again, aren't you?
I am. Yes, I still do quite a bit of work with Doctors Without Borders and have been working with them the past couple of weeks. And will likely be going to Kenya to train people who are going to the DRC. So it's still something that I'm passionate about. And I still believe that we can, you know, show how awesome America is by going and helping the people in the Congo to stop this outbreak.
Kevin, are you done writing about this, or what's next for you?
I don't know. I find this topic is endlessly fascinating. Infectious disease is such an incredible thing, and it's such a huge part of our world that you know, though this particular chapter, you know, may have come to a close, I have a sneaking suspicion that there'll be plenty more.
Well, I want to thank all of you for joining us today on Maine Calling to talk about Ebola. The voice you just heard, Kevin Hazard, he's the author of the book, No One's Coming, The Rogue Heroes of Our Government, The Rogue Heroes Our Government Turns to When There Is Nowhere Else to Turn. And it is about a very unusual operation to rescue people who had contracted Ebola in 2014. Patty White, Maine Public News reporter and host who covered this in 2014, and Casey Hickox, an infection prevention nurse still doing the work 12 years after she was at the center of national attention. Our sound engineer was Sam Tracy, Maine Calling produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow back on the program, we listen back to our earlier conversation about the links between arts, health, and healing. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.